Good evening, everyone. I'd like to call into session the April 7th, 2009 session of the House Subcommittee on Workforce Development. Good morning to everyone. We're going to open up this morning with an informational hearing on enterprise zones. And this is going to be a relatively short session because we have two bills to hear this morning. House Bill 2950, and my understanding is there are a number of folks from various fire agencies that may be a little concerned about this bill. It's my understanding that it didn't come out quite as people had intended. It warms my heart because I understand I'm now not the only one who has bills in this building that don't come out like I intended them to. So I am very sympathetic with your plight, and we'll hold a public hearing, and we're probably going to have a work session put together on that bill so that we get it right. And work group, excuse me, not a work session, work group. Thank you, Kevin. And to allay concerns on that bill, and then we'll finish up today with the House Bill 2951, the Electrical and Elevator Board folks. So with that, on our informational meeting, I'd like to call up first of all, please, Mazin, Ed Waters, and Art Ayer. They're going to talk to us about enterprise zones. Welcome to each of you, and good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. Is this a microphone that I need to get close or far?
Let's try it.
Okay, how's that? Works? Excellent. Each healing room seems to be different. For the record, my name is Mazin Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. And Chair Witt, we're here today, myself, and Art Ayer from the Employment Department, and Ed Waters, our economic consultant that we had for this study, to present to you on the enterprise zone study. And this study was actually asked by the 2007 legislature in Senate Bill 151. Senate Bill 151 asked the Legislative Revenue Office to prepare a report that evaluates the performance of the enterprise zones and related tax incentives under ORS 285C. And the bill asked for a very specific things about the effects of property tax incentives on state and local economies, public finance, government services, and also it asked about statistical analysis of change in measures, community economic hardship over time, and so on. Mr. Chair, you, through the interim, were the one who actually shepherded and looked at the different time posts, if you will, of changing in the report, and we came and reported to you at different times. But we're really happy at this time to say that we came to a point where we actually put together a formal work group as an advisory work group, if you will, and that advisory work group where Art Ayer, who's also did a lot of work with us in the Employment Department, Tony Ruffalo from Portland State University, John Hart from the Department of Revenue, Doris Penwell, Association of Oregon Counties, who's also here in the audience today, Hasina Squires from Special District Association is also with us today, Andy Shaw, Willie Tiffany, and Michael Novak, they all represented the League of Oregon Cities at different times in order to help us with the city's perspective. With all that work that we put together, the Employment Department Research Section and especially Art Ayer have helped us tremendously in pulling together all the employment data for a very complex and a lot of work type of sifting, understanding, pulling, and you would see with the time how much that have caused a lot of their time and effort, and we really are in debt to them for the results of this report. We also have pulled in the expertise and knowledge and the data analysis from the Economic Development Department, Artfish in particular, and they came very happily and advanced all this project and worked with us and Ed, and we got a lot of the results from the internal rate of return. For most of the results that you would have, let me just quickly put that the highlights of the results you have with the enterprise zone studies in the first page you have in front of you. We put in the report a little bit of the background, an introduction, and the methodology, data collection, and so on. The coming six pages, the seventh page will have the inferences and the results section, those starting from table 5, 6, and 7. And then we discuss the short-term trends. These are the ones from 1993 to 96 period. Then we go for the longer term on table 8, 9, and 10, and we discuss those results, and finally we look at the internal rate of return. So the whole analysis have centered around three main concepts: short-term benefits, and the time frame was 93 to 96. I'm still living in 93. 2003, 2006. Thank you very much. Oh, God, time passes quickly when you're having fun. And the long term, which one is that?
1990-2000.
Here you go. 1990-2000. That's a long term now. And finally, the internal rate of return for these things. I won't make it long. I'll let Ed discuss these results more in a little more detail with you, and bring you up to date quickly on these issues, and then Art and myself could probably answer more of your questions if you would like.
Very good.
Okay, thank you, Mazen. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ed Waters. I'm a private consultant living in Beaverton, and I was contracted by ILRO to help with this project. I have about 9 slides that summarize results, the process and the results for this project. As Mazen mentioned, we used simple methods to examine first-order measures of benefits and costs of Enterprise Zone program. On the benefits side, we examined change in covered employment between 2003 and 2006. 2003 and 2006 being the earliest and most recent years available, respectively, that contained the spatially specific or geocoded employment and payroll data that we needed for this type of an analysis. For the longer-term analysis, we use census variables to examine benefits in terms of broader socioeconomic effects over a 10-year period, 1990 to 2000. Again, we are limited by the period of the U.S. Census, 1990 and 2000 being the two most recent available census periods that we had at our fingertips. Also, we used a data set provided by the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department to extract estimates of property taxes foregone in enterprise zones, post-exemption property tax collections, and also the number of new jobs created in each enterprise zone during the exemption periods. An important component of this analysis was stratifying geographically our enterprise zones into 5 groupings, as shown in the slide. They're based primarily on geography, and the strata were urban metro, which includes the enterprise zones in the Portland metropolitan area, urban western valley, which are urban enterprise zones in the I-5 or along the I-5 corridor, rural west side enterprise zones, which contains enterprise zones in all other west side counties, rural east side, which contains east side counties except for the rural remote area, which are east side counties that lie off of major roads and particularly far from population centers. We selected two samples consisting of 1 to 5 enterprise zones from each stratum and used those for analysis of benefits. The samples, we selected two samples, one for identifying or analyzing the short-term benefits, and a second sample for analyzing the longer-term benefits. Another important component of this analysis was the selection of a control group, or comparison areas, as we call them, because it's not strictly a statistical control group. Comparison areas were selected to represent conditions in non-enterprise zone areas in each stratum, to determine candidates for possible matching as comparison areas. Each census tract in the state was assigned to a stratum based on the county it lies in, and that stratification is shown in Table 3 in the research report, which you should have in front of you. Then matching was achieved by comparing private industry employment profiles of the sample enterprise zones and the candidate tracks using a simple correlation factor routine. And this work was performed by the Employment Department. Then the candidates' areas which came closest to matching the enterprise zone employment profiles in each stratum were selected and designated as comparison areas for those strata. Our methodology for analysis. For short-term benefits, we compared the change in private industry employment and private industry payroll over the period 2003 to 2006 in the enterprise zones and compared that with the corresponding change in those variables in our comparison areas. For analysis of long-term benefits, we compared change in a group of census variables, versus the comparison areas, and that interval was 1990 to 2000. The specific census variables that we looked at included the poverty rate, unemployment rate, household income, housing vacancy rate, and median gross rents. On the cost side, cost of enterprise zones, we used the OECDD data set to calculate property taxes foregone per net job created in the enterprise zones in each stratum, and the number of years required to recover foregone property taxes in each stratum. Now, skipping to the results, detailed results of the short-term benefits analysis are found in tables 5 through 7 in the research report, and those Table 5 shows up on page 7, I believe. Results of the short-term benefits analysis show that growth in employment and payroll by participating enterprise zone firms was considerably stronger than in the comparison areas. And there is not really any discernible difference in employment growth between the comparison areas and firms in the enterprise zones that did not receive tax exemptions. But payroll growth may be somewhat stronger in some of the enterprise zone strata. In general, the rural east side enterprise zones outperformed the comparison areas by the widest margin compared with the other strata. Growth in employment and payroll in rural remote enterprise zones appeared considerably less than in comparison areas. And finally, growth in average pay for participating firms was less than in comparison areas in all strata except for the urban metro.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please, Representative Holby.
I'm just looking at the information that you've just presented, and it doesn't seem like, if I'm reading this correctly, that the enterprise zones are exhibiting growth in employment and payroll comparative to other areas. Am I interpreting that correctly? Is that what you're saying?
It's a multifaceted analysis, and there are different things to look at, I think, that you could key in on. It does appear that for the firms in the enterprise zones that are actually participating, that are getting the benefits of the tax exemptions, they are showing strong growth. Whether that is spilling over into other firms in the enterprise, within the enterprise zone, that are not necessarily participating in the tax exemptions, seems to be somewhat fuzzy.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Please.
Well, your statement is there's no discernible difference in job or payroll growth between the compared your CAs and firms in the enterprise zones that did not receive the tax exemption. So, to me, you're saying there really is no evidence that job and payroll growth in enterprise zones is any different than anywhere else. Is that a correct statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I think the more correct statement is that there's not a observable pattern. It seems that in some enterprise zones there may be an effect. In other enterprise zones, there's not. But when you look at all five strata, there doesn't seem to be a consistent pattern that we can point to and say, yes, this is occurring across the board.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I think the conclusions that come pretty obvious. Now, when you look at firms within the enterprise zones, we look at two different types. The type that did take enterprise zone incentives, and the firms that did not. So the idea, the ones that did seem to show a stronger growth in employment and so on, except, of course, with the rural remote that seems not to respond to any incentive for some reason. But what we would call the secondary effects, meaning is the question that we wanted to answer, does the tide lift all boats, that did not come out obvious. So the ones that actually invested into the program itself were the ones that generated that extra. The ones that did not see that secondary effect or secondary type of growth in that section. So you could say it is effective, but it does not make all the secondary effect come as much as we think they are.
Please, Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, I have maybe a more specific question than on specifically you were talking about your comparisons and what enterprise zones you were using, and specifically about the urban Western Valley. I know in the Eugene Springfield metro area over the years we've had a couple of pretty big enterprise zones that were used to attract some pretty large companies, and granted they produced a lot of jobs for a while. But I'm curious whether you used those enterprise zones. I'm speaking specifically, there was one in Springfield that about 1997, Sony was the big player in that enterprise zone. And I believe in about 2002 or so, Sony shut down and left. And similarly, in West Eugene, we had Hynix, who entered an enterprise zone about in, I want to say, 98, and then just about this last year, 10 years later, they shut down and left. So do you take that into consideration when you're talking about the growth in employment and in that time frame? Because there was a tremendous amount of money invested in that those operations, and when they closed, there was 1,000 jobs just disappeared overnight. So I'm wondering if that's in any of those two specific examples are in this data for the urban Western Valley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, Table 1 on page 3 and Table 2 on page 4 list the enterprise zones that we selected in each of our samples. In Table 1, for example, you'll see that under urban Western Valley, Springfield was one of the enterprise zones that did make it into our sample, and it also made it into the long-term benefits analysis sample, as shown in Table 2. For the employment and payroll growth, we were limited to the period 2003 and 2006 for reasons that perhaps Mr. Eric can explain a little bit better than I can. But that being the case, it may have left out the big changes that you're alluding to and with regard to that particular enterprise zone in the West Springfield.
Right, so the answer would be no, it doesn't take for the Western Springfield, then it wouldn't have taken in that loss in jobs to the, and I will say, the major user of the enterprise zone. And similarly, the Eugene, with its largest enterprise zone, isn't part of your sample at all, where we've just lost over 1,000 jobs after the company took a lot of credits and benefits from the enterprise zone. So anyway, I just wanted to raise that particular issue. I mean, I love the analysis and things, but I think that perhaps it doesn't really take in the full impacts of what happens after these enterprise zones get 5, 6, even 10 years old and companies shut down and you know, because they've exhausted the benefit, I guess. And so the long-term impact of that job growth is not being reflected in these statistics, I do not believe.
Representative Holvey, the problems with sampling and statistics, of course, that you don't take the whole universe and examine it. So there are things that you're going to leave out. What we were trying to do is get a flavor and a taste of how the Enterprise Zone program actually performed. Remember, of course, statistics is kind of dangerous. You could drown in 6 inches of water.
Exactly. Mr. Chair, if I may.
Please, bore down, Representative Holden. Bore down.
I mean, I'm drowning in 12 inches of water here because you're using 6 inches of water, and what I see, the major employer in two enterprise zones, both shut down, left the area, left thousands of people unemployed, and neither one of those scenarios are in these statistics, which is the major enterprise zone players in the second largest metro area in the state. So, you know, I guess I just am a little hesitant to, you know, I appreciate all the hard work and the statistics that go into this, but it just seems kind of odd that, you know, that large of a impact is left out of this analysis.
Chair White, Representative Holvey, this not necessarily was left out intentionally to not count that. We tried to sample in order to be able to. I mean, the sampling we had to do has to have an area of the examination and then a comparison area of somehow. And when we selected these sample points, we were trying not to be biased either in a statistical way, that is, in either too big or too small and so on. One of the requirements we had in the short term, for example, that the enterprise zones have to be continuously utilized. That requirement in the long term analysis was not required. We relaxed that in order to be able to answer the question, for example, if it is not been used, how does that impact the whole process of why do we have an enterprise zone kind of benefit thing? So we try to answer different questions with a different, and I understand that more inclusive, if you will, of the whole universe of enterprise zones could be done. Perhaps it will take a little more time, and I could almost feel a new project coming. Hopefully this time it will all be, we'll be able to have appropriation amounts with that to to look into it a lot.
Well, that's another room, Mazin.
Yeah. I'd be happy to go down there with you, though.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, if I might just follow up real quickly on that. At the end of this show, we list some recommendations for lessons learned, I guess, how we did it, how we might do it better next time. We were plowing some new ground with some of the data and some of the analysis that we did. We realize now that if I had to do it again, it would be nice to include all of the enterprise zones rather than sampling, and it would also be advisable to get as long a period between the employment data points as possible, which is what we did. We had 2003 and 2006 available, but if we did this analysis 1 or 2 years into the future, we could have a longer period of to measure employment change.
Gentlemen, too, I apologize, but as you go through some of this data, it may be easier for us to ask questions as you proceed, and we have two members here that have questions. First, Representative Dembro, followed by Representative Esquivel.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My question's about the final number five item and the lesser growth in pay for the enterprise zones, the enterprise zone firms. So is that a function of the nature of the firms that tended to use the tax exemption, or can you shed any light on that? Because that's a troubling statistic for me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembro, that's probably the case. It depends on the industry and the occupations in those industries that are being hired. I think we have someone here who can speak to that more directly. Maybe at the end of the presentation we can address that. Art Fish from the Economic Development Department has very intimate knowledge of what types of firms are taking advantage of the incentives in which areas.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel?
Yes, I'm kind of on these samplings. I think that it's very interesting that we do sample. You've taken, in my particular area, the I-5 corridor in 99 and the airport, which is a pretty slim area. I believe that we probably have several entities, and in the difference I see here is that we have, like BOC Gases, that has been there for 12-plus years. We have Certainty Corporation that's been there 10-plus years. Amy's Kitchen that's been there 5 or 6 years now, 450 new jobs. I mean, the list and the reconstruction of Boise Cascade when it burnt down on the I-5 corridor that's been there since 1940 or something like that. So it would be interesting to see the picture as a whole. The other thing is, does this come into much into expansion? Do we really get into the expansion part of the existing businesses on these statistics?
Chair, Representative Esquivel, this is, I'm going to use this the analogy of the cave again. We have, at one point, just to remind you what we're trying to do with this report. There was a lot of discussion in the previous sessions, especially in the 2007 session, saying what are we getting for the enterprise zones and all these different areas? And we were trying to answer all these questions, and all the answers were coming out of hypotheses, if you will. People say it's best thing after sliced bread, and some other people say it's the best thing before sliced bread. So I guess what we're trying to look at here with this, why we did the sampling, is we said, let's try to look at the beginning of it. Let's open a window, if you will, and try to shine some light around and see some of the contours of this big hole, if you will. And now what we're starting to do is look inside and get the idea that these things are happening. And we feel that we almost all of a sudden have an increased knowledge of what the enterprise zones are doing and how they are behaving. However, that does not mean that we understand all the behavior that is occurring or could occur in an enterprise zone, or how the employment and all the things that happen in very particular each different enterprise zone that could work. However, we think that this opened our eyes to what is next kind of thing. And in that sense, that's the way we saw the different sample points and how we compare them. We thought that these sample points make perfect kind of study point and with a comparison point. So in that sense, we were looking at it, and perhaps not single issue by single issue kind of thing.
Thank you, gentlemen. Please proceed with your presentation. I'm sorry if our questions threw you off, but
no, we love the question.
Great, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just in response and follow up, Representative Esquivel's question. I think if you look at Table 5 on page 7 of the report, in the top block, it kind of gets at your question fairly directly. On page 7, employment and firms participating in EASY program within sample EASYs. Those numbers there show the employment in firms receiving enterprise zone exemptions in 2003, the top line, and then again those same firms or the firms in those enterprise zones receiving exemptions in 2006. So you can see growth in most of those strata, all of those strata actually. So it gets at, I think, the expansion issue, at least to some degree, within the firms that are actively participating in the program. Again, it's a short period, 2003 to 2006, so you don't see big jumps. Moving on to the long-term benefits. The detailed results of the long-term benefits analysis are shown in tables 11 through 15. I should probably back up for a second real quickly just to refer to some tables that I'm not going to go into in detail here, but in the report, tables 8 through 10, so tables 8, 9, and 10 show some effects over different areas. What we were looking at there was comparing a change in census tracts that overlie or intersect in some way with enterprise zones in the state compared with census tracts that do not touch in any way enterprise zones within the state. And the point there was to try and get a complete universe. Yeah. So if you add up all of the employment in census tracts that intersect enterprise zones plus all employment in census tracts that do not intersect enterprise zones, it adds up to total employment in the state. So it's another way of looking at it. It's a way to maybe get at these spillover effects if they're there between incentivized activity in enterprise zones. Does that affect other activity in surrounding areas or within that same enterprise zone itself? It doesn't appear, at least our data, it doesn't appear that there is much of an effect in that regard. It looks like the growth between employment and payroll growth between 2003 and 2006 in the two types of areas was fairly comparable, except in the rural east side strata and rural remote strata, where the growth in census tracts that intersected the enterprise zones actually seemed to lag behind the enterprise zones that did not, or I'm sorry, census tracts that did not intersect enterprise zones. So it's sort of a reverse relationship in those cases, perhaps. Sorry for that confusion. Moving on now to the slide and long-term benefits.
Representative Esquivel?
Yes. Do we know why that has such a impact difference between rural Oregon and urban Oregon? Because that's what this is about. It looks like rural Oregon, that didn't help rural Oregon at all. Why is it?
That's a good question, Representative Witt, Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel. I think that's getting at the nub, mm-hmm. trying to get at the nub of this issue. There are people in this room that have a lot more insight into development issues than I do and could probably answer that question a lot more fully. But I think it's just, as we all know, it's harder to come up with incentives that encourage firms to move and establish themselves in those kinds of areas. It's just there's a lot of friction. There's a lot of disadvantages those areas have. It would take a larger set of incentives or prizes for a firm to move into some of those areas and establish, you know, new employment, new job growth. Whereas in a an area that's better served by our road networks or more centrally located with respect to supplying businesses, maybe a smaller package of incentives has the desired effect. They say, okay, this tax incentive is enough for me to want to invest in this area.
Representative Holby.
Just another, I guess, sort of fundamental question for me to understand this. When you're speaking of poverty rates in the comparative areas and also in enterprise zones, the same with household income, are you speaking specifically within the boundaries of that enterprise zone and then the comparative areas outside of that enterprise zone? And the reason I ask that question is because some of the enterprise zones I'm aware of anyway, there's very little housing in them. They're mostly industrial areas. So how are you measuring household income and poverty rates inside of an enterprise zone that doesn't really have, you know, households in it, I guess.
Let me take that. Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, on the long-term analysis, we use census tract data, and we looked at census tracts that... my name is Art Ayer. I'm the state employment economist with the Oregon Employment Department. And in the long-term analysis, we looked at census tract data from the 2000 census and the 1990 census, and each census tract tends to have somewhere between probably 500 and 3,000 house population. That's just the way the Census Bureau selects census tracts. There were some changes over that period in census tracts, and I made a heroic attempt, I'd like to say, in trying to match up the census tracts over time because there was a change in some of the boundaries. But in any case, after adjusting census tracts to make them comparable over time, what we were looking at is the demographic characteristics or the socioeconomic characteristics in each one of these census tracts that overlay an enterprise zone, which includes some population area as well. And these census tracts can stretch dramatically beyond the enterprise zone boundary itself. So they do have population, the ones that we looked at.
Yeah, thank you. That was the answer to my question.
You're welcome.
Please proceed.
Continuing with the long-term benefits analysis, the patterns we observed are that change in the poverty rates in enterprise zones versus comparison areas was fairly mixed. Hard to sense a good pattern. Unemployment rate declined more or rose less than in comparison areas everywhere except the urban Western Valley enterprise zones. Changes in household income and household vacancy rates were also quite mixed and not really a discernible pattern there. And median rent as a percent of median household income declined more than in comparison areas in only one stratum, that is the urban metro. So I guess in summary, it was difficult to see or detect much of a pattern of effect for enterprise zones or areas with or without enterprise zones using the long-term benefits measures that we examined. Okay, moving on to the last results slide. Again, detailed results of this analysis, the property tax and internal rate of return analysis, can be found in tables 16 through 18 in your research report. And the results of the internal rate of return analysis show that about 7 years are needed to recover the undiscounted value of enterprise zone property tax exemptions, with a range of from 3 years to 11 years, depending on stratum. Statewide, about $11,000 in property taxes are foregone per net full-time job created, with a range of from about $1,100 to $33,000 per job. But once you remove power-generating projects and projects that were granted away from the employment creation requirements by the enterprise zone sponsors from the data, then this reduces the value of the foregone property taxes per full-time job to $7,800, so from $11,000 down to $7,800. And the range narrows, the high end of the range goes from $33,000 down to $12,600 per job. Okay, summing up a little bit, we have some observations with respect to this analysis that may aid someone in picking this up again and trying to do a similar sort of a study. First observation is that, as we mentioned, 3 years is probably too short a period for the short-term benefits analysis. However, 2003 and 2006 were the years that we were limited to those years just by the data availability. Also, enterprise zones in the rural remote stratum in our samples were not established long enough to expect to see long-term effects. Of the three enterprise zones in the rural remote stratum that we examined, two were established only in 1996, and the third was established in 1999. 1999 was the year that the 2000 census was administered. So, unfortunately, again, we were limited in that the rural remote stratum enterprise zones have been established only much more recently than the other enterprise zones in the state. Also, issues not addressed in this analysis include the effect of property tax shifting, present value analysis, that is, discounting the flow of or foregone property taxes or future property tax collections. We didn't get into that. That could be done. And also the question of attribution of development impacts, which I'm sure you're all interested in, and that means would the investment have occurred without the property tax or the enterprise zone incentives in place, or how much of the investment would have occurred, you know, had the incentives not been in place. We didn't go into that kind of a question. However, I think there are some systematic ways to address that, at least do some what-ifs, run those kinds of scenarios. And I think that the data set developed by the Economic and Community Development Department can possibly be utilized to do that kind of an analysis or take that kind of look at things. My last slide lists some recommendations for future analysis again. So some lessons learned. One, we should define the geographic strata based on divisions finer than counties, for example, using census tracts. I think this is doable. As we mentioned, we should probably use all of the enterprise zones for our analysis rather than selecting only samples. This will eliminate the issues that we talked about relating to sample selection bias. And it would be nice to be able to use a longer series of data to make the employment and payroll comparisons, as well as possibly using some more sophisticated time series analysis or statistical methods. This is sort of a technical point, another technical point. For the long-term analysis, we perhaps should look at selecting comparison areas by matching socioeconomic characteristics in the comparison areas versus the enterprise zones rather than industry employment profiles, which is the way that we did it. Also, it would be advisable to include a fuller accounting of benefits and costs, including effects on public finances and provision of services that that might entail. And also looking at perhaps the second round economic impacts derived from project investments and employment in the enterprise zones. And I think the other two recommendations I mentioned in the prior slide, that is using discount rates to look at the effect on present values of property tax flows in the future, and including that in the analysis, and then also addressing the issue of whether the investment would have occurred without the property tax incentives in place. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's all the report that I had on this on the research report.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes. Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the work that's gone into it. One question. I know that it's kind of troubling the short time period that was in this from 2003 to 2006 for the employment and payroll data. And I'm curious why that employment data wasn't available for years prior to 2003, because I know in my particular county I've seen that data on those enterprise zones going back much further than that. So I'm curious why the lack of data, I guess, for that.
Chair Witt, Representative Holvey. The data that we used for the short-term analysis was the covered employment and payroll data series from the Oregon Employment Department, and we specifically used geocoded, or as Ed called it, spatially specific employment data. And our GIS folks indicated to me that the pre-2003 data were not sufficiently reliable to use, and at the time that we did the study, the 2006 data were the most current available. We now have 2007, and in fact we've gone back and re-geocoded the earlier years with the new geocoding, what they call the new geocoding engine, to make the data even more reliable than it was at the time we did the study. But they have not, to my knowledge, gone back prior to 2003, and I think part of the reason for that is just weaknesses that are inherent in the data. And, of course, even if we go back to 2001, that's probably the earliest we can go back to reliably and get any industry type information, because there was a change in industry coding between 2000 and 2001. But our GIS folks told me that the 2003 data was the earliest that they would recommend using based on its reliability.
Mm.
Now, there are, of course, data on enterprise zones themselves, and I believe that is taken into account in the third portion of this study that go back substantially farther. But this was just the geocoded Oregon Employment Department data that was available from 2003 to 2006 at the time that we did the study.
Please, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate that. I guess not knowing the importance of geocoding, I suppose, to a statistician is, I guess, a thing that pops into my mind. And because I know we have employment data going back further than that, but you're saying that it's not reliable because it's not consistent with your geocoding system?
Right. Chair Witt, Representative Holvey, we do have employment data by county back to 1976. The 1976 to 2000 data are essentially a consistent series in the what we call the SIC coding system or the Standard Industrial Classification coding system. Between 2000 and 2001, there was a change to what we call NAICS, the North American Industry Classification System, and we
right.
also have county-level data from 2001 through now, the second or third quarter of 2008. But those data are specific to the county only. They're not specific to the specific location within an enterprise zone. So when we're analyzing an enterprise zone and we have an electronic file that indicates the latitude and longitude of the boundary of that enterprise zone and we're trying to identify which companies are within that boundary, we need to use what's called a geocoded data set, which identifies the latitude and longitude of each firm. And that data set, as I say, was only available from 2003 to 2006 at the time we did the study. But we do have county-level data going back much farther. And those county-level data do have addresses. They do have zip codes. If we were looking at zip code-level data, we might be able to go back farther. But there are also a number of firms that do not have really reliable addresses. That is to say, they may have a post office box. We have perhaps a zip code, but we don't know where in that zip code they're really located, so we assign them to the center, the geographic center of the zip code. We're not sure if that's within the enterprise zone or outside the enterprise zone. That kind of uncertainty exists.
Sounds like another appropriations issue.
I like what I'm hearing. Chair President Hovey, the intent was for this study that we are trying to really see things, or trying to establish some level of visibility of the data without biasing ourselves, our data, or beginning with either this assumption or that. And in order to be able to do that, we had to rely tremendously on the employment department data, because it was coming on top of all the assumptions that exist, and we used all these different census tracts to kind of put together the enterprise zone versus a non-enterprise zone in order to be able to look at the thing and reliably say this is what looks like is coming out of it, without necessarily being prejudged or pre-biased before that or after it. Because the other data we do have, the internal rate of return, how much did it cost us? That is in the data from the Economic Development Department. How much did it cost per job? How many jobs did it? I mean, all these things work, but we wanted to look at them from different angles in order to be able to form some level of knowledge about it.
And my probably my last question and statement for the day, perhaps to let you off the hook here. I mean, I'm not against enterprise zones. It may seem like it by my line of questioning. Your number seven bullet up there really kind of hits a point, I think, because how could you say, well, if it weren't for this enterprise zone, this wouldn't have happened? You know, I've heard similar arguments with different kinds of tax credits or abatement programs that basically say, well, if we didn't have the enterprise zone, we wouldn't have had this growth or this investment. It's a pretty hard thing to prove, I think. I don't know how you actually answer that question down the road. Because frankly, you could make a case that this growth would have happened with or without the enterprise zone, and certainly if it's there, people will take advantage of it. But I'm wondering, at the same time, do you take into account not just the job growth for that particular company that utilized the enterprise zone, but what about the revenues that went into that enterprise zone that may have actually been providing jobs with local government or some other fire district or the government entities that no longer have that tax money coming into them. You know, there's probably a loss of jobs, I would think, because they've just lost a bunch of revenue. So I'm just wondering if you weigh that into your scenario of job creation and job growth.
Chair, with Representative Holby, let me just emphasize here that we really do appreciate all these questions. We do. And I suspect you chose the Legislative Revenue Office and Senate Bill 151 to conduct this study because you know that we don't have a position whether we're pro or against enterprise zones or any other programs, and you wanted to see an objective way of evaluating this type of program and whether it works the way it is intended to work and how much output or outcome is that doing. And that's the way we're trying to look at this issue and evaluate it. So in that sense, in order to answer that question, we say we made a lot of strides in understanding. However, we don't have the answer to that particular question. We know that enterprise zones from the data and analysis that we've done are effective on certain levels, on employment and payroll. They're less effective on level of pay, for example, as the data suggests. They do have this as the enterprise zone firms that take advantage of the tax incentive, the property tax incentive. But it does not translate to all the other associated firms. So the argument that says enterprise zones are a good incentive, it seems to be true. However, the argument that says the suppliers will also come in and push this and you'll have a whole percolating economy of zone because of the suppliers and the chain and so on, that did not seem to be obvious. So there are different things that come out of the study. And one of the things, too, says this is how much it costs you in revenue for local government to create these jobs. Now, whether that amount or that price tag is the right price tag, that's your decision, and you would have to come up to different policy discussions of how much and why is it good or is it a bad thing. We're trying to, as I said, shine the light within the cave in order to show you this policy and its objectives and whether it is achieving those objectives or not. And we really truly enjoyed this study, but if you want to go further, as I was saying again, let's have a little more
FTE
allocation. For the employment department, Mr. Chair.
There we go. Art, did you have anything additional to add?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I'm just, given all the caveats and the what-ifs here, do you gentlemen have confidence in the conclusions that we have drawn here, that growth in the enterprise zones may be less than the control areas, those sorts of things? Growth in average pay, I guess it was, maybe less. Do we have any confidence in that conclusion?
Mr. Chair, I guess I would say that one further avenue of examination would be to look at the industry of the sample firms mm-hmm. in the enterprise zones and compare those to firms in the same industry outside in the comparison areas or elsewhere and see what the relative performance was, because it could be that because of the enterprise zone program's limitation of participation, it could focus the participants in certain industries that have over the sample period, over the study period, have had poor performance than many of the firms in comparison areas, which include all industries.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one possible further examination that could be done.
Chair Wett, I think the issue of confidence, we do have confidence that we've used the best available at this time.
Yes.
Data.
Yes.
We were able to, I think, use this data in ways that perhaps we didn't know that we can use this data this way before. I think we broke some new ground with the help of the Employment Department and Ed and the Economic Development Department in pulling so many strings in from different places that were able to give us a new way of understanding enterprise zones. However, it does not give us a complete way of understanding enterprise zones. So we know a lot more, and we think that data says a lot of information about the enterprise zones. It says what, you know, the different ways of what they're good at, it seems, and what they're not. However, it is not the end or the definitive answer to everything. We don't have flashlights everywhere, if you will. We just have, we could see in so many yards deep within the hole, if you will, or within the cavity of the earth. We haven't struck oil yet.
So. We've perhaps identified some trends that need further investigation before we can have a definitive conclusion.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair,
so caution would be in order here. Representative Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. One question has just come to me. If an enterprise zone, one of the benefits of an enterprise zone is it creates more employment and that generates more income taxes, right, which benefit the state as a whole. Do we have a sense of whether or not the industry that is taking advantage of enterprise zones is paying corporate taxation at a commensurate rate with those not in the enterprise zone? Or are there patterns that way that have been looked at in terms of the impact on the state general fund?
I have no idea.
I just wonder if they're contributing more than other firms, less than other firms, by the nature of the companies that tend to take advantage of those incentives.
President Dimro, I think you probably are putting the new touches and the new coming project for the. I don't think we have identified the tax payment as to the general fund, whether it's corporate or within the income tax for the companies that have took advantage of the enterprise zone. I don't think we have gone in that route. I can see that it could be done. I don't think we've seen it within the scope of this project. Mm-hmm. However, it does not mean that it is not something that we could not be investigated at a certain point. I suspect maybe some level of, and this is just thinking loud, some level of privacy concerns might be, except if they are publicly traded companies and so on. So there are these things that might occur. Because we ran into some of that issues, and we have to do all things in the aggregate rather than one per one. When the discussion was how we pull the data and how we look at the different companies, not all companies are public, and not everybody knows how much this or that kind of number is. Mm-hmm. So perhaps that could be something for the future. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Dimbro, not to the corporate income tax, but rather to the personal income tax issue. If you look at Table 7, you do see the average pay per worker in the firms participating in enterprise zones and in the sample areas, all of the firms in the enterprise zone sample areas, and then the comparable areas, the comparison areas. And you do see that the enterprise zone program participants have, on average, a higher average pay, and that should translate through to higher personal income tax. But again, this doesn't touch on corporate income tax. Mm-hmm. And that probably, again, has largely to do with the nature of the firms that are participating.
Right. Yeah, just, you know, if I could make the point, I think if we're going to do a real sort of global analysis for policy purposes of, you know, the value of the programs, I think it would be useful to look at that as well to see that, you know, the total impact. And, you know, it might be possible to be investing in other sorts of companies that might actually be generating more corporate tax revenue.
Chair Witt, Representative Dimbro, I might quickly add that that's a good point. Our tax systems have changed considerably since the beginning of the Enterprise Zone program. Our property taxes have changed under Measure 5 and Measure 47, Measure 50. So now it's the effects of granting tax exemptions is considerably changed from what it was in late 1980s or early 1990s. Also, the corporate tax system has changed quite a bit. Now we've moved toward sales-driven tax allocation. So that is a big change from the way it was when enterprise zones were originally coming into being, and also differentiates the effects on different types of firms depending on where they operate and where they sell. But those are good points. Those are things that could be looked at.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Certainly appreciate your coming today and highlighting the conclusions of this study. I think the jury's still out, but we certainly know, I think, based on this, where we need to perhaps develop some more data. And it's an area which several committees in the last session were very interested in with some considerable amount of concern. I think some of the questions still remain unanswered, but I think also your recommendations underscore the importance of our asking you to do this study in the first place. So thank you all very, very much. Certainly appreciate your coming out today.
Welcome. Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Columbia County Commissioner Tony Hyde and Hasina Squires. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Welcome and thank you for
waiting for the lights to come back on.
All right.
It's creepy sitting up here without the lights. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to have this invitation to testify before you regarding the Enterprise Zone study. A couple of things that I want to start by saying for the record. Hasina Squires, on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, first of all, would like to thank the chair for his leadership in getting us to this place. For those of you who were not here last legislative session, Representative Witt was very instrumental in pushing Senate Bill 151 forward. And making sure that this sort of examination of enterprise zones occurred. Second thing I'd like to say is legislative revenue has yet to indicate the fact that this bill did not go through Ways and Means last legislative session. They actually provided all of this research and all of this data on their own dime within their existing budget. So I think it's really important to note that for the committee that this good work was done without any fiscal impact, absorbed within their budget, and a lot of time on behalf of legislative revenue and the stakeholders, and also Economic Development Department, and also Employment Department, but EDD spent a great deal of time providing information for this study. A couple things that I would just like to highlight for our association, for those of you who've been around, we know you probably recall many times that I've testified on behalf of enterprise zones and our concerns as special districts. Special districts do not have the ability to choose whether or not their taxes are abated within an enterprise zone, and it has been a concern of many of our districts, particularly public safety districts, fire districts who have to provide services to those enterprise zones while taxes are abated for a number of years. A couple of things I just like to highlight that were in the study that we think the committee should give special consideration to, and then a couple of recommendations or suggestions for progress in the future. Since 1995, $233 million in property taxes were forgiven statewide. Nearly one half of that was for projects located in the urban Western Valley. A quarter of that was located in the rural East Side, and only 1% of those, 1% of that property taxes was went to projects located in rural remote areas. And when the program was created, it was definitely meant to aid and assist rural Oregon, and I think that's one of our concerns about the program is that it is now spread to a statewide program that's benefiting I-5 corridor and poor rural Oregon, who's trying to compete with businesses and location of businesses, is having a difficult time doing that because of the proliferation of the number of enterprise zones in the state. Secondly, it does take, according to the results of legislative revenue, approximately 7 years post-exemption to recover the undiscounted value of property taxes. That's a long time. It is the range is 3 to 11 years, but 7 years, in our opinion, is a really long time, and we do want to highlight that for the committee. The undiscounted value of statewide property tax exemptions per full-time new job is $11,000 per job. That's a large number, in our opinion. And then finally, the short-term analysis, and I think that's part of the limitation of this review, is the short-term analysis shows you one thing, the long-term analysis doesn't show you much because of the lack of employment data, but the short-term analysis showing that no discernible difference in job growth for firms located in E-zones that didn't receive tax exemptions and firms not located in enterprise zones, that's a significant finding that we'd like to highlight for your just review. A couple of suggested changes that our association would like to just have the committee consider. This is something that this is a consistent recommended change on our part. If you look at the findings, the legislative findings of the EDD of the Enterprise Zone Program and the EDD statute, it specifically highlights this program as for it should be located in areas outside major metropolitan areas for which geography may act as an economic hindrance. If this program has now become a statewide program that we're encouraging it to be used statewide, not for rural Oregon, the legislative findings should match that. It shouldn't be couched as, oh, this is a program for rural Oregon, and we're trying to bring jobs to the rural parts of our state by incenting businesses to get a tax abatement to come to rural Oregon. If it's in fact being used, the majority of the taxes are being abated in the urban I-5 corridor. One of the things that I do want to respond to, I can't recall if it was Representative Holvey or Representative Esquivel, this issue of why don't they come to rural Oregon, why would they be more likely to locate in a corridor, there are just certain things, and this is not meant to be offensive at all to the rural legislator sitting on, particularly rural legislator sitting on the committee, but there are certain things about rural Oregon that you just can't overcome, and when you're competing with I-5 corridor locations, transportation limitations, infrastructure limitations, access to labor, the ability to finance, those are four key components of things that rural Oregon is somewhat disadvantaged at when competing with locating a business in the major metropolitan area. Another thing we'd like you to consider is allowing public safety and education to be given the opportunity to decide not to participate in the exemption provided by the enterprise zone. It's 40 to 50% of the taxes abated. And then finally, just to summarize, the results of this program are mixed, and we don't oppose enterprise zones. Some enterprise zones work great. Some do not. Some companies leave immediately after they get the tax abatement, and they go away. But it's a cumbersome program. There are a lot of people working on this program. The state has a huge, rigorous set of criteria and guidelines and forms you have to fill out. Assessors are involved, local economic development officials. Something that maybe should be considered is just to consider expanding the construction exemption and streamline the program and call it what it is. It's an incentive that benefits everybody in the state. It's not necessarily geared towards rural Oregon anymore. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Hasina. Before we entertain questions, I'm going to have Commissioner Hyde move forward, and then we'll have questions for both of you.
Good morning, members of the committee, Chair Witt. I'm Tony Hyde, County Commissioner in Columbia County. Also, for the purpose of this report, I'm on the Oregon Economic and Development Commission, and also founding member and executive board member of Columbia Pacific Economic Development Area and Northwest Oregon Economic Area. So I have some level of expertise when it comes to economic development, both in the northwest part of Oregon and in the state of Oregon. With regard to this study, I'd go back to a quote that Ben Boswell from Lowell County said, "If you've seen one county, you've seen one county." And if you've seen one enterprise zone, you've seen one enterprise zone. This is a very, in my opinion, inconclusive study. It needs to be widened and needs to be over a longer period of time. We've been in a bubble and bust economy, and to try to take a component of that bubble and bust economy and have a study that's unequivocal is just not, in my opinion, well vetted. So this is a study that is a snapshot in time, but it really doesn't give us any kind of a comprehensive answer. And I also believe that the recommendations that were made were very good, and that we should follow those. I think that we need to have some answers with regard to all the incentives we have in the state of Oregon. So the more that we track these and have some unequivocal results, I think the better off we all are. Having said that, I am a big supporter of enterprise zones. There's been a lot of discussion and a lot of changes suggested to our existing rules and enterprise zones, in particular around prevailing wage. And I would just say that in our county, with existing rules as they are today, prevailing wage is not an issue. We require prevailing wage in our enterprise zone. And you can do that today. It doesn't have to be mandatory. And I'll also say that enterprise zones are a tool in a bag. They're not an end-all. And in a lot of cases, with a lot of recruitment, an enterprise zone simply won't work, in particular with the things that we have today as compared to in 2003, like this SIP for $50 million and up in investment as compared to the large SIPs that used to be there. A lot of enterprise zones that we're taking advantage of today would not be as a result of more tools in that pouch that we have. So I'm clearly here for not for any particular testimony, but at the representative's which request to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Holby.
Thank you. You're a perfect one for this question, I think. In the comment that Hasina Squires made about the, I guess, the value per job that the taxpayers are actually paying for these jobs in enterprise zones is $11,000. And then I flip over to the chart where the average pay is $37,000 for jobs in the enterprise zones. So essentially, taxpayers are subsidizing the payroll of these companies that are taking advantage of the enterprise zones by that much, and that comes out largely, I think, out of county and city budgets. So I would guess I'm seeing that there's got to be a reduction of services at the county level or at the city level because these monies are no longer going into your general fund. They're being used to subsidize the wages of these companies who may at some point return income to the state or to the local governments. I'm not sure, you know, how does a commissioner weigh that you know, situation and come to a conclusion that this is beneficial for our county government or this is beneficial for our community? Because essentially your taxpayers are subsidizing the wages by almost 30% for these companies, and they're doing so. In doing so, they're foregoing, I'm assuming, services from their local governments.
Chair Representative Holy, that's a good question. I'll give you a demographic that's general that might explain why that's important to us. First of all, when we sponsor an enterprise zone to a company, all of the sponsoring agencies that are signed on to the enterprise zone have to sign it. And in our case, in one enterprise zone, it's Columbia County, Clatsop County, the City of Rainier, and City of Clatskanie. They all have to say, this is a good idea for our community to be a sponsoring agency into the enterprise zone. But more importantly, generally the numbers from economists, and I've heard this more than once, are that for every dollar that we get in taxes from a homeowner, it costs us about $1.07 to $1.20 in services that are required for that homeowner. Schools, fire, police, etc. For every dollar that we get from a business, it costs us about 51 cents to provide those services. So clearly, every time that we become more and more of a commuter county, which in Columbia County's case is significant, well over 65%, and some of our communities over 95%, when we're a commuter county, we become a donor county to some other county. Because every time somebody builds a house without a job equated to it in our county, we go backwards in terms of being able to provide services that we're required to provide as a local government agency. And every time that is reversed, we go the other way. So it is incumbent upon us to create jobs. The ancillary businesses that are not exercising the enterprise zone benefits are significant when we have an enterprise zone sponsorship generally. So that's why I would really condone and do condone a much further study so we can really look at this number.
Additional questions or comments? Hasina, I'm curious because you mentioned fire districts, and I'm presuming that while it's in the interests of many of us to try and create the kinds of jobs that Tony was just describing, for some of the special districts, when we've created those jobs and we brought another business in, at the same time that you've realized you have failed to realize a revenue increase during the abatement period, there are additional requirements for fire service, fire coverage, safety protections, those sorts of things, ambulance services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you deal with that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, well, it's an interesting question because the enterprise zone program has grown and our property tax structure has changed in the last 20 years. So I'll give an example. Clackamas County Fire District number 1, Precision Cast Parts, big user of the enterprise zone program. They will get the taxes eventually. They'll get the abatement. It will come onto the roll. But in the meantime, additional services are required. And what happens is it's cost shifting. So existing residents within the district, but for the fact that they would have had these taxes and they would have been paying their, I won't say fair share, they would have been paying for those services at Precision Cast Parts. Other residents of the Clackamas County Fire District number 1 are then subsidizing or receiving either one of two things, lesser service or lesser service for everyone in the district in order to provide services to an abated tax-exempt property that needs it. We or raise taxes, local option levy, and we're limited by, you know, the 3% limitation. So it's betting on the come. It's if we create the job, first of all, if we grant this, will they come? Or would they have come anyway? I think that's the core question. Would they have come anyway? Would Google have located their multi-billion dollar company? Probably. It's not because of our enterprise zone. As Tony said, it's a tool in the toolbox, so to speak. But do the residents of the taxing district that are foregoing that property tax revenue receive a lesser level of service? Most likely. Or does the taxing district increase their revenue? Probably.
And so I want to reserve what you just said here just for a minute and ask Tony to give an example, because we've had several good ones in Columbia County of bringing in companies with economic development zones. Can you give us a good example here of a success story?
I can give you two, Mr. Chair. One is, and I think this is very important, this is not about attracting new industry any more than it's about expanding existing companies. We had a company in Columbia County, I should say, we have a company in Columbia County that makes parts for work trucks all over the world. Very successful mom and pop company with about 110 employees. First of all, they were extremely upset that we attracted a company, USG, because we gave them all of these enterprise zone benefits, and they were right next door, and they were very incensed and really ripped me about how could we give them, you know, an enterprise zone advantage like that, because they were thinking about expanding, and there was no way that, you know, that they could compete when they don't have those kind of advantages. And I said, well, wait a minute. An enterprise zone, when it exists, is an entitlement. And if you provide $10,000 of investment in a new job, you also get it. I said, oh, well, never mind. It turns out this company was actually looking at going across the river to Longview. But once they found out that they had an enterprise zone available to them for an expansion project of their existing company, they stayed and they expanded. And we have quite a bit, now that we're past the 7 years, have quite a bit of tax revenue that's come onto the rolls. I think we would have lost that company. I think they would have been across the river. But more importantly, we have USG, which makes the sole owner of the word sheetrock. They invented it, and they've been around for over 100 years. They're a Fortune 500 company. I picked that back. They're a Fortune 300 company. They're not in receivership. And they came to us saying, listen, we want to build a new sheetrock plant in Northwest Oregon. We've looked at your site in Rainier. And we've got, orders to build 10 new plants across the country. And we know that it costs $90 million to build a plant. We do it all the time. And we also know there's no such thing as a perfect site. So we put $10 million on top of that. I have $100 million to build this plant. It's going to cost us $119 million to build on that site. Buy down the difference and we'll come. Otherwise, we're gone. Because if I spend that extra $19 million, that at the end of the day, that's one plant I'm not going to be able to build. And that's exactly what they're looking at when you're talking about competing with other sites. And that's where these kinds of tools become very, very valuable. And we're really not talking about competing within the state of Oregon, area to area. In fact, there's defining limits on mileage of competing areas written into this. We're talking about competing with other states. And frankly, other states have toolboxes too. And if ours don't match theirs, we're not going to be competitive. USG did come. They provided, I think it was $160 million worth of investment, 180 jobs. We had some requirements on there that we can't put it in writing, but we certainly had bent noses with regard to, we wanted our employees at this plant to be from Columbia County. And they're still, I think the last time I checked, over 75% of the employees are from Columbia County. So there's a direct benefit for us. And it's been a very successful company, as an example. One other one was one that went awry. which is the Warner Mill, which has had several iterations of owners. And that's where we learned that we wanted to have prevailing wage written in because they brought travelers when it came to the construction. So we have since built around that. We did provide a enterprise zone for that $450 million investment. They came. They built the plant, the new paper machine. They hired the folks. A year and a half later, they laid more of them off than we had in our enterprise zone agreement. They had to write us a check for $1.9 million. They come and they do not live up to the requirements. They pay it back with interest, and they had to do that. So we have some very good and very tight rules with regard to how this works, existing today.
So this success story, and there are several of them, and Tony, you and the other commissioners have done a tremendous job in bringing in the kinds of development that benefit the community and the county, great wages, and you manage the thing with clawbacks and the whole bit. This is a success story. But we've added a burden to other levels of government. And Hasina, you used a word that really struck home with me, cumbersome. And while we have created a big success in many regards, we've also created a number of challenges for other levels of government. Have folks thought about how we make this less cumbersome, less challenging?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's sometimes a case of it's so because of the very things that Tony has testified to, they're all good things.
Yes.
But they are cumbersome.
Yes.
And so it's are they so cumbersome that you spend a lot of time running red tape and paperwork, or are they do they need to be just streamlined and just provide a flat-out exemption? It's a policy consideration for the legislature.
Yes.
Should local government be mandated to be responsible like Columbia County and require a prevailing wage? Should local governments be responsible and be mandated to provide local higher jobs? That's a policy consideration for the legislature.
And thank you for underscoring that for us. Representative Esquivel. Mark, you raised your hand a minute ago.
No, I did.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Representative Holby has.
Huh?
Thank you.
What?
Well, you know, I really appreciate, Commissioner, your success story. You know, USG is a huge company, great company, lots of jobs, and I applaud you for your, you know, you're doing what you possibly can within the current law to get prevailing wage. You're absolutely correct. Our current statutes allow that to happen. It's up to the particular sponsoring agencies to make that happen, as well as the clawbacks for when they don't perform. You know, certainly the state could look at, you know, demanding those sorts of requirements too, but I keep coming back to Hasina's argument and your argument, and I think you made a really good point about, you know, we're looking at these things. They are a tool, and we use them to attract businesses, largely from to Oregon from going someplace else. And though that can be extremely beneficial, I think there's also a big danger in that too, is that your companies can whipsaw states in competition with each other, and it becomes who's going to give away the most tax money to us, and that's where we're going to go, and so you end up in essentially a bidding war or a race to the bottom at some point that you have to recognize and say, when is you know, when is the price tag too much? And I mean, that's the difficult position that we're in, is saying, well, how much of the taxpayers' money are we willing to give away to have the benefit of this particular business in our community? And that's really the tough decision, and a fascinating one at that.
Well, Chair, Representative Hovey, I agree with you 100%, and there is that danger. And we, at least from my perspective, we look at enterprise zones as a component of a very good package that we put together that is not solely based on incentives or the incentive package, but the site and why that site for this particular company works well. And we really don't say this site is the end all for all companies. And I think that's a mistake that folks get into. But you need to find the specifics around the site, the demographics that site is perfect for, and go after that demographic. And frankly, the enterprise zone, if you're really using it in a large recruitment, it becomes a tie tack in your dress uniform. It's not the sport coat. It's not the basis of your uniform. It's the dress up, the final piece that may or may not break a deal. And sometimes it comes down to that. But if it's the end all, we're in real trouble. If the incentives are the end all to recruit or attract businesses, we're in real trouble as a community, I believe.
Thank you.
And that may be a Representative Escobar, did you
have one real quick thing is that I think what we have to realize here is, one, we are competing with other states. Other states even give them property, period. The other thing is you have to look at is if they aren't here, then we don't have it in the first place. The last thing you have to realize is, as for districts, you're saying it other people do without less services. Your district doesn't grow. It doesn't shrink according to who comes into that district. The tax base doesn't shrink. It's an addition to it eventually. So I'm going to have to disagree with you on that point. I think that if you don't have it, it's not there in the first place. If you do have it, and you don't get any revenue on it for the first 3 years or 2 years or 5 years or whatever the situation is, and eventually it kicks in, that's more than you had to start with in the first place. It's not money out of your pocket. It's money from the future. And it is an established business, and you're talking property taxes, but more importantly, we need to think about payroll taxes, because that's what drives this state.
Commissioner Knight.
Chair Witt, and members of the committee, I just want to say that I do think that as an enterprise zone sponsor, that I personally have a responsibility to all the constituents in my community, including and especially the special districts, 911, the fire districts, etc. Having gone through two catastrophic events in Columbia County in the last 11 years, we're very cognizant of the importance of the fire districts as an example in our community. And we try to make accommodations when we can make serious, large considerations for tax incentives, both enterprise zone and urban renewal. And we have a couple of urban renewal administrations in our county as well. As an example, when we did an urban renewal plan in Clatskanie and I for Port Westward, we brought the special districts to the table. And in fact, in our urban renewal plan, there's a new fire hall and new fire apparatuses built in. And I think that's the responsibility that we have, is to bring all the stakeholders that are affected by tax incentives to the table when we talk about these issues in the first place. And then we don't end up polarized at the end.
And I want to thank both of you for your testimony, because you have avoided precisely that polarization in your testimony and have brought to us issues that we need as a legislature to consider in terms of public policy. And I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for your excellent testimony, and I think the two of you, frankly, ought to go on tour together, because it's just perfect, the issues that you bring to us. Cumbersome and inconclusive, two words from each of you, and very much appreciate that. Thank you again.
Thank you.
With that, I am going to close the informational hearing on
enterprise zones, and I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2950. Kevin, would you give us a brief review of that bill, please?
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, I'll give a very, very brief review of HB 2950. Essentially, the bill as it stands right now provides that a building described or building during construction is not going to be subject to more than one inspection by the state fire marshal in compliance with the fire and life safety. There are also provisions regarding the number of inspections that could be performed by a municipality or local government. There is a dash one amendment that came to us late yesterday that modifies the bill itself that would tweak the language in terms of the number of or when inspections can in fact take place. We do not have the fiscal at this time with respect to this. There is a revenue showing no revenue impact on this bill.
Thank you very much. And just one item of housekeeping. Because of the time, folks, I'm going to have to carry over House Bill 2951. Okay. Just so that if there's anybody here that's waiting for that, my apologies on that. And also, just a reminder that we recognize that the amendments to 2950 may not be exactly as folks had wished for. We're cognizant of that, and we're going to be headed towards a work group, so you may want to keep that in mind as you present your testimony here today. So I'd like to call up, please, as a panel, Randy Simpson, Doug Whiteley, and Jenna Ingram, please. And my apologies for making all of you wait for so long.
What the hell? I made a change in it.
Welcome to our subcommittee. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please determine who goes first.
I guess
first.
I'll go first.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee, Randy Simpson, State Fire Marshal. With the information that you have provided about going to a work session, I'll keep mine relatively short. This bill is written, and I have not had a chance to totally analyze the 24-page amendment. So a work group definitely is the route to go here. We need to know what the specific problem is, then we can work together to address it. For over the last 4 years, the Office of State Fire Marshal has worked diligently to come up with a program that was directed from this building several years ago to get competencies within the fire prevention inspection program. Since that, we have provided well over 4,000 recognition certification and task books to fire prevention inspection professionals throughout the state of Oregon. One of the main other issues that we do is we constantly push and strive to have a program where planning, building, fire all work together with the developers and contractors to make a very smooth transition of a construction of a new facility. And I do have a great success story that just completed this week here in Salem, very large program at the hospital. One of our deputies and the local billing officials and fire districts worked together hand in hand. They finished a month ahead of time and well under budget. So when they do work together, it does work. And I'll conclude my testimony at this time.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Jenna Ingram, representing the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, Clackamas Fire, and Special Districts Association. I know you have a 10-15 floor session, so I'll just be very brief. The fire service has reviewed the bill. I reviewed the amendments late last night. There are, of course, concerns, as you're aware of. Just wanted to let you know that you know, happy to work with the interested parties in a work group here in the building every day. And you know, I don't have any horror stories for you, but I do have Doug Whiteley from Clackamas Fire who has a couple of comments for you.
Thank you for your offer to serve on the work group. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Witt and representatives, for the time to be here. My name is Doug Whiteley. I'm with Deputy Fire Marshal with Clackamas County Fire District Number 1. And part of my job at Clackamas County is I oversee our new construction portion in our fire prevention office. I work really closely with all the building departments. Over the past 3 or 4 years of working close with them, we have continued to grow on a relationship with this, and they rely heavily upon us for fire and life safety input. Limiting our involvement in that would really put a hamper on their ability to apply the code as necessary. Bringing us in late in the game would indeed cause issues with getting stuff complied correctly. You take an example, this type of building here, your fire sprinkler systems, you're going to look at those a minimum four times from beginning to end, probably, to get a good, complete fire inspection upon those to make sure they're going to be working properly, designed properly, and are going to stay together if they are used. Over the history of past 100 years or so, you can see fire code, building codes increase on, restrictiveness, involvement. The involvement with the fire service has grown over that time, and you look at the death rates, they have dramatically decreased over that time. This House bill, I think, would probably set that back a great deal of time for our ability to prevent those fire deaths. At this point, I don't have any further comments.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the committee members? I'm not seeing any. Thank you all very, very much.
You.
Certainly appreciate your turning out today, and we'll try and get this right before we send it anywhere. Let's see here. Next up, we have Terry Hatch from NECA and Tim Nickel from IBEW. Would you come forward, please? Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. Thank you. Welcome.
I'm going to keep my comments pretty brief. My name is Terry Hatch, and I'm currently the executive manager for the Oregon Pacific Cascade Chapter, NECA, and Eugene, and I'm testifying on behalf of 400 electrical contractors throughout the state of Oregon. This is a very important bill. Contractors, developers, and designers tell us that the lack of consistent code development and enforcement across all of the codes adds significant cost and delays to the construction process, which is further exacerbated by over 100 different jurisdictions that our contractors work in. The fire code's never really been clearly integrated in the statewide code, and it results in cost delays, expensive rework, and uncertainty for the construction industry. This onerous burden falls heavily, though not solely, on the electrical contractors who install fire alarms, egress and exit lighting, and other life safety systems. After the jobs are awarded, contractors apply for the permit so they can actually build the job. And it goes through a plan review process. That's really where the problems begin and end. It's not our intent to remove the fire marshals from the billing process. Their expertise and experience adds a value perspective to code development and enforcement. But we do need to put all aspects of the building codes under one statewide code and one statewide administration for delegation. There's been a lot of problems over the years. There's been five opinions issued by the Attorney General answering questions posed by administrators of the Building Codes Division dating back to 85. So the opinions are varied and contradictory. Nothing else, they demonstrate that existing statutes are unclear. And we'd like to recommend that we form a work group and be happy to participate in any way that we can.
Thank you. I certainly appreciate that offer. Also, before those of you who would like to be part of the work group, before anybody leaves, I'm going to ask that when we're done here today that you sign up with our committee assistant here, Keith Bassett, and he'll need your name and a good contact number where we can get a hold of you for those purposes, okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Tim, good to see you. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Witt and committee. For the record, my name is Tim Nickel. I'm the business manager of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 280. I'll be extremely brief. After talking to the fire marshal, I think that I'm tickled pink that we'll have this work group, because I think that both sides are very close. They just have some stuff to work out, and in our busy schedules, we don't get to talk a lot of time. So that's all I'm going to say. Thank you very much.
Great. We'll get this thing worked out here and make it that silk purse here before we're done. Representative Esquivel.
So what does that mean that we're dealing with, Mr. Chair?
Actually, the most frustrating thing for me to see is that we're supposed to have one uniform building code in the state of Oregon, yet there's no two municipalities or counties alike. It's very interesting. If you go into southern Oregon, you have nine different municipalities and nine different ways to interpret the codes. And to me, that's astounding to me that we would have such a thing, but it's true. And hopefully we can get this resolved and get in the right direction.
And I want to thank both of you for your willingness to get us to that point,
thank you,
too. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And the last folks we have on the sign-up sheet, at least, are Doug Young and Ralph Groner.
I support the work group.
Thank you, Ralph, very much. Love that testimony.
I have written testimony, and I support the work group.
Thank you very much. Certainly appreciate it. And if the two of you would wish to be on that work group, too, we'd welcome you.
Mr. Chair, I want to mark this down that Ralph Groner said one sentence.
Amen. Yes, this is a this will get out in history. Thank you, Representative Esquivel. Is there anyone else from the public who would wish to testify at this point on House Bill 2950? I'm not seeing any. We are going to form that work group. Folks will please see Keith to sign up with that. And if there's nothing else, I'm not seeing anything on this bill. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2950. And I am going to briefly open a public hearing on House Bill 2951, only to say that, sorry, Tim, but I'm carrying this one over. We're closing the public hearing.
To Thursday.
Is there, I'm going to carry that over until Thursday. Just show of hands, was there anybody else in the audience who showed up today for this one? Okay, sorry, Tim. We're carrying over until Thursday. We'll see. And with that, anything for the good of the order of the subcommittee? Not seeing anything? Okay, see you all on Thursday.